You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, uncertainty about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
So what we found was that the disturbance that we observed was less than that which was predicted by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
The holographic universe?
If I have some region of space and I want to describe gravity and particle physics and everything that's going on inside that region of space, the holographic principle would tell you that there's a way of describing that physics in terms of objects that live on the boundary of that region.
And art, music, and particle physics collide in the Jiggling Atoms exhibition.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
Welcome to the FQXI podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute, where we round up some of the best physics and cosmology news and research from the last month. We have to begin with a quick congratulations to Serge Haroche and David Wineland for winning the Nobel Prize in Physics. Both work in the field of quantum optics and independently devised methods for measuring and controlling fragile quantum states without destroying them.
Well, you know, Brendan, if you like hearing about tricky quantum optics experiments that test the foundations of our understanding about reality...
And who doesn't?
Then you'll love our first item about a quantum optics team based at the University of Toronto that has put Werner Heisenberg's own explanation for his uncertainty principle to the test and has found it wanting. Tell me, what do you know about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle?
I know that it's one of the first rules of quantum mechanics that physicists learn about, which tells us that you can't know everything about a quantum particle at one time. So you can't know both where an electron is and where it's going at the same time. The more accurately you know its position, for instance, the fuzzier is your knowledge of its momentum.
When Heisenberg proposed it almost a century ago, he also offered a very simple picture, or thought experiment, to help people understand why this strange idea is true. Imagine, he said, if you try and pinpoint exactly where an electron is. To see where it is, you must fire photons, or particles of light, at it. But bashing the tiny electron with a photon disturbs its motion, changing its momentum from what it would have been had you not looked. So you cannot know where the electron would have been heading before you made the measurement.
Heisenberg's microscope example. That's a nice explanation.
Yes, it's a very helpful picture, but I hope you're not too attached to it, because quantum physicist Lee Rosimer at the University of Toronto and his colleagues recently performed a test to see just how much the act of measuring an object actually disturbs its state. And they found, well... They found that it doesn't disturb it as much as you might expect from Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
No, you're taking away all that's sacred to me from my quantum physics education.
I'm sorry, I'm afraid I am. Rosimer kindly chatted to me about the experiment, details of which are published in Physical Review Letters, and told me why he suspected that Heisenberg's microscope paints a picture that's a little too pessimistic.
So that explanation of the uncertainty principle is kind of the way Heisenberg himself motivated the uncertainty principle. And it's the idea kind of encapsulated in Heisenberg's microscope. So if you have some electron and you want to know its position, you have to measure it. And measurement is a physical process. So to measure the position of the electron, you have to interact with it in some way. So Heisenberg imagined what would happen if you tried to measure where the electron is by essentially shining photons or particles of light on the electron. And what he showed is that whenever the photons interacted with the electron, they would disturb it in some way. And the more precisely you measured the position of the electrons, the more you would disturb the momentum of the electrons.
So that's basically this idea that we keep hearing, that the reason you can't measure the position and momentum of something at the same time is that when you try and measure the position accurately, you fire photons at it and you kind of nudge it, and that knocks its momentum.
Yeah, that's right.
So now, why were you interested in looking at that more closely? Why didn't you just sort of take it at face value and say, okay, that sounds good?
Well, I guess it's been known for a little bit that this isn't really rigorously true. It's been known for a while. And so in 2003, Professor Ozawa actually derived a different relationship that he said this precision and disturbance relationship should follow. And the interesting thing about that relationship is that if you kind of naively apply the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to measurements, meaning that the product of the precision and the disturbance has to be greater than some value, you actually overestimate using Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So you can actually measure precisions and disturbances which fall below the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And Ozawa derived this new value. And then a little later in, I think about 2010, London Wiseman came up with this proposal how you could actually measure the disturbance that a measurement apparatus creates. And they used some concepts that our lab has worked on in the past, namely weak measurements. So we kind of thought we might actually be able to measure this disturbance, which kind of seemed very tricky to do in the past. So it just seemed like a good opportunity for us to investigate kind of a interesting fundamental question.
So you've actually carried out this experiment in the lab now, but you didn't look at position and momentum, did you? You looked at two other quantities that also should obey this kind of Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So we looked at different polarization components of a photon. So the polarization of light or of a photon is just the direction in which its electric field oscillates. And you can measure that polarization component along different directions. So you can measure how much it kind of, very roughly speaking, how much it's oscillating along, say, the z-axis and how much it's oscillating along the x-axis. And there's a Heisenberg uncertainty principle which applies to these variables as well.
Right. So you assume that you can't know both of these two with precise accuracy at the same time.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And so how did you carry out the measurement in the lab? Was it very difficult?
So the basic idea is to measure some disturbance to a quantum system. You need to know the value of the thing you're interested in disturbing. So you have some variable, and you want to know how much a measurement of that variable disturbs it. And so to do this, you would ideally measure the value before your measurement apparatus you wish to characterize, and then measure that value again afterwards. And the problem with that is your first measurement to check what the value originally was is already going to disturb your system. So then you can't really separate out whether it was your kind of check measurement or the actual measurement apparatus you were characterizing, which introduced the disturbance. So this is where the idea of weak measurements comes in.
Can you explain to me what the difference is between a strong measurement and a weak measurement?
Yeah. So again, any measurement in the lab, we really have to implement by an interaction between the quantum system or whatever system we're interested in measuring and some other system. I'll call it our pointer system. So the idea is we have a quantum system, we let it interact for a little bit with a pointer system, and then we make measurements on a pointer system. And kind of any normal measurement can be modeled in this way. So if the interaction is strong, then it can obviously disturb that quantum system. The idea of a weak measurement is that we make that interaction very weak. So now the pointer doesn't interact very strongly with the quantum system. The problem with this is that the pointer also doesn't get very much information out about the quantum system. So on a single shot, you might not be able to tell if that pointer really moved at all. So we have to repeat this experiment many times and kind of use some statistics to see where the pointer actually lands on average. And this is what we take as the weak measurement value.
Okay, I see. So a strong measurement can be quite accurate and it can tell you exactly what value something has, but in that case, it can disturb it quite a lot.
Yeah.
By contrast, if you do a weak measurement, you're only looking sort of at something very, very gently.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to take a little bit of information about the state of the system, but that's not going to be very accurate because it's such a weak measurement. So you keep doing it again and again and again and again, each time only interfering with it very slightly. And then you kind of take an average of the measurements that you got to kind of give you an estimate of the value to be measured.
Yeah, that's right. So the idea we want to implement, ideally, you want to first weekly measure your system, then send it to your measuring device, the thing that you want to know if it disturbed your system or not. And then after your measuring device, you can do a normal measurement on the system.
Okay, and so, you know, what did you find?
So what we found was that the disturbance that we observed was less than that which was predicted by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, if we naively apply it to measurements.
So you've been very careful to say that you got a different value than would have been predicted by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle if you think about the principle in a naive way. So, you know, what does this mean? We're not saying that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is wrong, but I guess we have to be more careful about exactly how we state it?
Yeah, so the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in itself is correct. It just doesn't apply to measurements. There's just a different principle which applies to measurement, this relationship which was derived by Professor Ozawa. So the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in itself just talks about kind of intrinsic uncertainty in quantum states. So it just tells you if I have a quantum state and I prepare it with a certain distribution in one variable. So I know I've prepared it with its, say, position defined to within a certain extent, there has to be a corresponding larger uncertainty in this particle's momentum. And it doesn't talk about what would happen if you were to try to measure those positions and momentums.
Thank you to Lee Rozema for explaining his experiment to Zia. So Heisenberg's uncertainty principle does not apply to measurements. My illusions are shattered. But Heisenberg's principle does still stand and describes the intrinsic properties of quantum particles.
You can read more about the debates over quantum uncertainty and the role of measurement in our articles and blog posts. For links, visit our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. There you'll also find an extended version of the interview with Rozema, where he describes the steps of the experiment in detail. If you like the terms entanglement and quantum teleportation,
which I do,
then head over to the podcast page for more about how entanglement and quantum teleportation were used in the experimental setup.
So weak measurements played an important role in carrying out that test. And did you know that the idea that such gentle measurements could be carried out at all was proposed by FQXI's own Yakir Aronoff? FQXI doesn't just produce awesome podcasts and articles.
Even if we do say so ourselves.
We also give money to researchers looking into foundational questions. In our last grant round, for instance, we funded research looking into the implications of Aronoff's ideas for understanding the nature of time. There's more about that FQXI-funded research in the March 2012 podcast, which you can still download, and in which Jeff Tollickson ponders whether quantum laser experiments have shown that the universe has its own set destiny. Now, we're happy to announce that we have just opened our next large grant round.
And what's the topic this year?
The topic for this round is the physics of information. Let me just read from the official statement. The past century in physics has shown a progression away from thinking about physics at its deepest level as a description of material objects and their interactions, and towards physics as a description of information. Information appears to lie at the heart of statistical mechanics and thermodynamics, quantum mechanics, and possibly even general relativity. So, FQXI is looking to award a total of $3 million in grants for research on foundational questions related to the physics of information. Research should be in physics or related fields like cosmology, biophysics, computer science. Relevant questions might be ones like, what is the relationship between information and reality? How does nature process information? Are there fundamental limits on information processing? What can the physics of information reveal about black holes, singularities, physics at the Planck length, and the origins and fate of our universe?
And as always, there's more information about how to apply for a grant on the website www.fqxi.org. You can also contact us with questions about the grant round at mail@fqxi.org.
That's just for grant round questions. Please, if you want to ask about the podcast, contact us at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter at FQXI.
In many ways, winning an FQXI grant is even better than winning the Nobel Prize in Physics.
That may be going a bit far.
Well, in some ways it is.
Name one.
You get to be interviewed for the FQXI podcast.
Okay, that's true.
With the new grant round starting up, this seems like a good time to catch up with how some of FQXI's previous grant recipients have been getting on. Alex Maloney and Robert Brandenburger at McGill University have been using their FQXI grant to investigate some bold, brain-twisting ideas of their own. In particular, combining string theory and cosmology to recast the universe as a hologram. Together, they hope to find out when time itself began, as reporter Corinne Piekema found out.
At McGill University in Montreal, Canada, theoretical physicist Alex Maloney is applying string theory to basic conceptual puzzles in quantum gravity, and he's especially interested in black holes and cosmology. String theorists suggest that the elementary particles present in the entire universe are made of small, one-dimensional loops of energy. The theory tries to reconcile quantum mechanics and general relativity. In 2008, Maloney received a grant from the Foundational Questions Institute for a rather spectacular idea. His aim is to try to understand the birth of our universe by creating a hologram of it. The ultimate aim of the project is to find whether the Big Bang was indeed when time began. To find out how the research is going, I caught up with Maloney on Skype. I first asked him what it was exactly that he had proposed to do.
The grant was given for work involving applications of techniques in string theory, in particular applications of what is known as the holographic principle, to cosmology. And cosmology being the study of the evolution of the universe as a whole.
The holographic principle has been around in physics for several decades, but it was described in its most precise form only a decade ago by a string theorist called Juan Maldacena.
The basic idea of the holographic principle is that the degrees of freedom which describe gravitation can be encoded in a theory of physics that lives on the boundary of space-time. The sort of most basic way of thinking about it is in terms of black hole physics.
A black hole is an object in space that is so dense that not even light can escape its gravitational pull. Light is kept within a boundary surrounding the entire black hole, called the event horizon. Besides stopping light from escaping, this event horizon also stores or encodes all the information contained within the black hole. Just like a two-dimensional hologram encodes information about a three-dimensional image. And scientists are now starting to be able to decode this information in event horizons, a technique they have termed the holographic principle.
It turns out that when you study the dynamics of the evolution of the universe, it's possible for the universe also to have event horizons. So just to be a little more specific, if I have some region of space and I want to describe gravity and particle physics and everything that's going on inside that region of space, the holographic principle would tell you that there's a way of describing that physics, not in terms of objects that live in the interior of that region of space, but instead in terms of objects that live on the boundary of that region. The holographic principle is an attempt to make this sort of simple geometric picture very precise.
In the late 1990s, astronomers discovered that the expansion of the universe appears to be speeding up, which many think is caused by the influence of some unknown dark energy pushing the cosmos outwards. This discovery now allows Maloney and others to apply the holographic principle to cosmology.
According to this discovery, the rate at which the universe is expanding is accelerating in time. So the universe is not just expanding at a constant velocity, but the velocity at which the universe is expanding is increasing in time. And that means that eventually the universe will be expanding so rapidly that if I'm here in the Milky Way galaxy and you're next door in the Andromeda galaxy, then these two galaxies will be speeding away from each other at such a high velocity that it would be impossible for us to communicate with one another. Because even if I were to send you a signal at the speed of light, it would never be possible for that signal to reach you because you would be receding away from me so quickly. In this case, there is effectively an event horizon. And so the techniques that we've developed to study black hole physics can also be used to study the sorts of event horizons that will arise in cosmology.
And it doesn't stop there. One of the most interesting theories that physicists are discussing at the moment is the theory of inflation. According to this idea, at a very early time, the universe was expanding exponentially, and this expansion was happening so rapidly that event horizons were created between regions in space. This idea makes it possible to study the universe, even in its infancy, by applying the holographic principle.
The goal of this program of research is to take some of these very remarkable and precise ideas and to try and push them one step farther to understand situations that would describe the evolution of the universe.
But to answer the highly complex question of what happened at the birth of the universe, Maloney has to start small. To date, he has focused on a simplified model to gain the first very basic information.
My particular research has focused on some very simple models of cosmology. And it turns out that one radical simplification is to study cosmology in a universe with two spatial dimensions. So it turns out that Einstein's theory of general relativity is relatively simple in a universe with only two spatial dimensions rather than three. And so if one wants to study the quantum mechanical version of that theory, that will also be simple. Now, of course, that's really what physicists like to call a toy model. Obviously, we live in a universe with three spatial dimensions, and so we have to be careful before trying to draw too many conclusions. But it's a model where we can do all of the calculations that we want to do, and where we can try to answer very, very basic conceptual questions.
Maloney is, of course, not working alone on this ambitious project. Robert Brandenburger, who is professor of physics at McGill University, is one of Maloney's close collaborators. He is interested in the singularity of time. In other words, a single point at which time began, believed to be at the Big Bang. I caught up with him via Skype while he was attending a conference in Germany and found out that it is not fame or money that drives this research.
My hobby is research. And one of the questions that I'm really fascinated by is the question of whether there was a Big Bang or not, in the sense of a time before which there was no time. The universe is now expanding, and if you extrapolate this expansion back into the past, you seem to find that there was an origin of time. And that brings about all kinds of philosophical problems, but also physics breaks down long before we reach that time.
How did you get involved with Alex in this project?
Holography is an approach which comes from string theory. And Alex Maloney is a string theorist. I'm a cosmologist. And so it's an ideal project to combine string theory and cosmology.
So have you had any results yet?
Yes, we have partial results. We are able to carry out this program in a space-time which is homogeneous. We can resolve the Big Bang singularity in that framework. But our universe has spatial fluctuations. So what we are working on now is we are trying to see whether we can still resolve the singularity even if we include small amplitude in homogeneities.
Maloney and Brandenburger have used the money from their grant to take small steps towards answering one of the fundamental questions about what happened at the birth of the universe. By applying string theory to cosmology, the researchers are able to look back towards the very start of time and space, using a clever technique that allows them to decode what is almost like a zip file containing all the information from the origins of the universe. This is only the start of what will likely be a prolonged project that will reach well beyond the duration of this grant. But the success of the collaboration to date has already convinced both that there is much to be gained from this approach.
With more work, I'm also optimistic that we will be able to make predictions for observations that come from this stringy picture of the early universe, which involves the hologram.
In general, our understanding of how to apply the rules of quantum mechanics to cosmologies, to universes which are evolving in time, is very poor. And it's that subject that we're trying to understand.
Alex Maloney and Robert Brandenberger were speaking with Corinne Piekema there. And you can read more about their work on the holographic universe on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Arrgh! First you tell me that I've been taught the uncertainty principle wrong. Then you tell me that I should imagine that the universe is a hologram. My mind is now as warped as space-time around a black hole. I don't think I could take much more.
Stay calm, Brendan, please. How about we move on to ways to discuss complex ideas from particle physics?
No!
Using art and music?
Okay. Is it soothing music?
It's quite mesmerizing. Earlier this month, I visited the Jiggling Atoms exhibition in London, which brought together work from 25 artists and musicians. Their works depict different aspects of physics, ranging from the innermost workings of the atom to the notion that quantum objects can behave as both waves and particles, or wave-particle duality as it's known, to the lifestyle of physicists. Some of the artists were kind enough to explain to me their thought process while creating their pieces to illustrate the sights and sounds of science.
My name is Jimmy Billingham. I'm a musician. What this kind of work is, it's really a kind of figurative expression of the wave-particle duality. And I guess the way I kind of explored that was to just use a simple kind of synthesizer, a monophonic synthesizer with an analog tone that's generated, just to kind of explore how different frequencies can interact when they're quite close to each other. You get a beating effect, which is caused by constructive and destructive interference between the two. And on top of that, I was using a granular synthesis effect, which breaks down the sound into small particles, essentially, and I kind of automated that to create a kind of change over time in the way that was manifesting. So simultaneously you have audible wave and particle characteristics occurring simultaneously.
Jimmy Billingham's sound piece, representing the quantum phenomenon of wave-particle duality, is one of more than 20 depictions of physics being shown at the Jiggling Atoms exhibition in London in October. Other works on display include sculptures of astronomers, comic strips, illustrations, continually evolving models, and even board games. This science and art project has grown from a collaboration between artists and physicists, including Malte Oppermann, a PhD student in the Quantum Optics and Laser Science Group at Imperial College London. Oppermann and others organised a crash course for the artists at Imperial earlier this year to help introduce them to the realm of particle physics.
As a PhD student, I sometimes have the feeling I'm a bit on a lonely island doing my research for a handful of people who are interested in it. But when I started giving these lectures, I realized that these people who sort of have a hate-love relationship to this topic, they studied art also because they wanted to get away from the natural sciences sometimes, they were so excited.
One thing that strikes me as I am walking around here is that as a physicist, you're often dealing with concepts that are very, very abstract, like you say, very mathematical, that often physicists don't really know how to visualize themselves. So do you think that provides an opening for artists that maybe the other scientists don't have?
Absolutely. This is also the reason why we did those lectures. We were hoping that by giving this group of artists a basic understanding of what physicists are doing and especially how they look at the world, we would give them the opportunity and the ability to forge their own vision of these processes and descriptions and thereby provide a depiction that is much more accessible to people who are not physicists, because the people who make these depictions, our artists, they aren't professional physicists, and that's the basic idea behind this exhibition as well.
So these really are sort of works in progress. So in the background there we can hear there's actually a workshop behind us and people are making things while we're talking. So that's a slight sort of strange drilling noise in the background. You were involved with this beyond just giving the lectures. You've really been quite hands-on in terms of putting the exhibition together. Can you talk a bit about that?
The overall structure was that these artists then went along and used their favorite techniques, their skills, to create artworks about things they found particularly exciting. But our group, as the curators and the organizers, we of course had to make sure that there's an overall context, that we create corners where different pieces have a relationship within each other. So for example, we have one corner in the exhibition which we called something of a sacred place, where there's just two fundamental equations in physics lit almost like in a little chapel, and we've put a bench in front of it. And we've put right opposite a work which is much more colorful and much more personal, and we hope to really contrast a few different feelings towards this discipline. On the one hand, something that to some people seems like an intouchable, intangible truth, but on the other hand, also the emotions that are connected to these new visions onto the world. What does quantum physics mean to me? What does it mean that these microscopic objects are completely random in their behavior?
The colorful paintings that Opperman describes, which have been placed opposite his sacred space, were created by artist Penny Klein. She painted two alternative versions of the same hilltop landscape. The first is a chaotic swirl of red, blue, green and yellow dots and squiggles, while the second uses the same colours to build the hilltop from bold geometric shapes. The paintings represent two competing views of the atom that Klein learnt about in the lectures.
Okay, so I had two paintings, both of which are of the same landscape, based on the two perceptions I had of the atom that I'd learnt. So one was trying to visualise somehow my idea of looking at something, looking at a landscape and drawing that as though I see it as a, what is it Feynman said, if you look at it the right way, the world is a dynamic mess of jiggling things. And the second one, rather than thinking of the atoms as these little squiggles moving around, I was thinking about them together and the way that they behave, the patterns that they have, and thinking about how we describe nature in terms of mathematics and the rules that these atoms dictate rather than participate in. The piece, the painting, is of the same landscape but made up entirely of geometrical forms. So that underlying the painting is Euclidean geometry that I've built up with the paint. So one is kind of chaotic, one is completely ruled.
Other artists have chosen to focus on the act of doing science itself. Peter Nencini's installation is made up of a series of pegboards mounted along a wall and is in constant development. Seated in a workshop housed within the exhibition space, he has continued to watch recordings of the physics lectures, and when a certain aspect catches his attention, he adds items, loops or wires, for instance, to the pegboards to capture the sense of what he has heard. Nencini's toolkit represents the process of actively doing science, a continuing pursuit with no definitive endpoint.
The pegboards are blank for the first couple of days of the exhibition, and I gradually fill them with a kit of parts that I've designed and cut or materials that I've found. What's important about the materials is that they're sort of fundamental and available and humble. So rubber, plastic, simple wood, steel, fixtures and fittings. So I'm watching the lectures again, and when something interests me, then I make a composition. So for example, I've just been watching again the second lecture, which was really all about Newton and the inverse square law. So I'm sort of twisting a piece of elastic in my hand to create a torsion, which represents one of the experiments that they discussed. So the compositions are subject to revision, they're non-definitive, but they're ways of locking down a piece of information so that I can keep hold of it and then claim it in my own physical terms.
Nencini was not the only artist to tackle elements of doing science. Artist Natalie K. Thatcher, who originally conceived the Jiggling Atoms project, and Ben Still, a particle physicist at Queen Mary University London, have developed a board game called The Race for the Higgs. Together, they explained how the game lets players experience some of the excitement and some of the tribulations involved in hunting particles at institutes around the world, including at the LHC at CERN in Switzerland, DAISY in Germany, KEK in Japan, and Fermilab in the United States.
The whole idea of the game is to go through and discover the entire standard model and then finally put into place the last pieces, which is the Higgs boson.
So you start off at your home institute, which is CERN, DESI, KEK, Fermilab. You go around the particle detector ring. First of all, you build your detectors. So there's solid detectors on the board and you spin them round to build your detectors. And after your detector is built, you can start collecting data. So when you start collecting the data, you piece together puzzle pieces in the middle of the board, which is the standard model. And as the standard model fills up, you're publishing papers. You progress more and more in your scientific career until you eventually discover the Higgs and you probably publish millions of papers and get loads of points.
So, Ben, you're a physicist and this is, you know, sort of as much, I guess, the life cycle of a physicist as it is about physics. So, you know, what were you trying to say about a career in science?
Well, just trying to say that publications and involvement in experiments are very much a key part of the career, and at the same time tried to keep the whole probabilistic element of particle physics alive as well, with the fact, you know, you randomly take pieces of data out of a data bag and you don't know what it's going to be. And also the fact that you've actually been able to collect the data in the first place is dependent on the roll of a die.
There's also chance cards, which mean your detector could be down for the summer.
Yeah, so, I mean, the chance cards as well throw in either a spanner to the works or give you a boost in your career. It may be that you get extra funding because, for some reason, a politician likes fundamental science. Or it could mean, as Natalie said, one of your superconducting magnets explodes and you have to have some downtime to repair your particle accelerator. And we've tried to, you know, get in as much of experimental side of things and career-wise side of things as we can into the game.
The Jiggling Atoms exhibition has been particularly satisfying for artist Jennifer Crouch, who spent 3 years studying physics at university level before moving on to illustration. Crouch also lectured the artists alongside Still and Opperman and has been impressed by the range of pieces on display and the ideas that the artists have chosen to explore.
But what I think, for me personally, has been the most striking thing about this project is seeing what aspects of the topics that we explored during the lectures have excited people's imaginations. So, Rachel Matthews' piece.
So, just for our listeners there, that's a very sort of eye-catching piece, which is a big bathtub with a flannel in it.
Yeah, and she was looking at ordinary things that are in her house, looking at her dad's flannel, and there was a hole in her dad's flannel, and she was like, where have all those particles of flannel gone? And it was like, yeah, we want people to think about that and think that they've actually gone somewhere and this whole thing, but they're still around somewhere. Maybe they just are in a completely different, in a different way. And she's also knitted lots of cosmic foam. And as a reference, I think, more of a cultural reference. So it's interesting, again, seeing how it is that people try and say, oh, well, this is a bit like this and it's a bit like that. And there's a bit in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where there's something about the universe going down a plug hole. And so there's a kind of reference to that as well. And that's really interesting, too, because science does exist in people's imaginations. And it really makes them think about, you know, the terrible and wonderful things that it can do. But people don't really know how rigorous it has to be in all these other aspects of science methodology. But people always dream about it. People really do.
What do you hope people will take away from this exhibition?
I'm hoping that people will be able to take away the fact that anyone can have an experience with this subject and have an authentic and genuine encounter with physics, and that it's not something that's completely remote. One of the things that we have been inspired by in this project is there's this thing that Richard Feynman says in one of the interviews with him in the Fun to Imagine programme with the BBC that he did, I don't know when, where he says, you know, there's no magical person that does physics. You just have to be interested and you just have to work really, really hard. And I think all these people are interested in what it is that physics tries to do. I think that if you speak to most people in the public, most people are just like, that's incredible that there's this huge detector, you know, kilometres under the ground that's speeding up particles. That, you know, it is an incredible story.
Physicist Richard Feynman's quotes inspired others at the exhibition too, including Jimmy Billingham, who sampled some of the Nobel laureate's words in his sound piece.
There's a Feynman quote in there which you can hear, you know, where he says, "Lost in the mysterious universe, it doesn't frighten me." Maybe just a sense of awareness that we're in this kind of huge thing that we're all kind of somehow trying to make sense of. And, you know, and art does that. Music, I include, you know, within that in certain ways, and science does that. So, you know, I think that's why this exhibition is so great, because it's kind of bringing those together and then, you know, just kind of seeing what happens.
Thank you to the organizers, artists, and physicists behind the Jiggling Atoms exhibition for speaking to Zia. The exhibition is now closed, but if, like me, you want to see more of the work they described in that piece, then visit the FQXI blog, www.fqxi.org/community/blogs, where you can see and comment on photos of some of the art. The exhibition's own website, jigglingatoms.org, will also update you on future projects.
That's all we have time for today. So thanks again to Lee Rosimer, Alex Maloney, Robert Brandenberger, and Corinne Piekema. You can contact us at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter at FQXI. He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.